Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Evaluating Legislation Impact, the Maryland Public Health Dental Hygiene Act webinar. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. If you would like to ask a question during the presentation, please use the chat feature located in the lower left corner of your screen. If you need to reach an operator at any time, please press star zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded, Tuesday, April 9th, 2013. I would now like to turn the conference over to Sandra Dietz, Public Health Policy Analyst at American Public Health Association. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Sandra Dietz, and I am a Policy Analyst in APHA Center for Public Health Policy. On behalf of APHA and our partners, I want to welcome you to today's webinar, Evaluating Legislation Impact, the Maryland Public Health Dental Hygiene Act. Today's webinar will discuss the background and impact of the 2008 Public Health Dental Hygiene Act, which was passed in order to increase access to oral health services for the underserved in Maryland. The Office of Oral Health is one of six awardees out of a pool of over 120 applicants that was given funding by APHA as part of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's National Public Health Improvement Initiative. The Office of Oral Health was funded for a period of about 12 months to conduct an evaluation of their Public Health Dental Hygiene Act. Before we get started, I just want to thank all of our co-sponsors, the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, the National Association of County and City Health Officials, the National Network of Public Health Institutes, and the Public Health Foundation. And I'd also like to thank our funder, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I would just like to mention that the contents of today's webinar are solely the responsibility of the presenters and do not represent any official views or endorsement by the CDC. This webinar is not designed to support or defeat the enactment of any legislation pending before Congress or any state or local legislature. A few reminders before we begin. If you have any technical issues at any point during this webinar, please use the chat function, which is located on the lower left corner of your screen, and also use the chat function at any time to submit questions for the Q&A session, which will follow all of the presenters. A recording of this webinar, along with the slides, will be available on APHA's website in the next few days, and you will receive an email once the recording and slides are available. We're also going to be offering certified in public health continuing education credit, CPH credit, one credit for anyone who's interested, and you will receive, everyone who's registered for the webinar will receive an email shortly after the webinar is over with instructions for how to obtain that. And I'd also like to thank you in advance for filling out our short evaluation survey that will pop up after the webinar is over, and that information is very helpful for us to improve future webinars. And now to introduce our speakers. Our first presenter will be Dr. Harold Goodman, who is the Director of the Office of Oral Health and President of the Association of State and Territorial Dental Directors. Dr. Goodman will give the background and an overview of the Public Health Dental Hygiene Act.
Thank you, Sandra. Again, I'm Harry Goodman.
Right, Harry, I was going to just quickly introduce Deborah and Sue.
Okay.
Sorry about that. Following Harry's presentation, we'll have Deborah Levy. And Deborah is an evaluator, social scientist, coach, and facilitator, and the founder of SuccessLinks LLC, which provides tools, services, and guidance to those working for social change. She will talk about the evaluation design and the results. And our final speaker will be Sue Kemmerdays, the public health dental hygienist at Chase Brexton Health Services, a federally qualified health center in Columbia, Maryland. Sue will speak about how the Public Health Dental Hygiene Act has affected their oral health program. And sorry, now I'll hand it over to Dr. Goodman. Thank you.
Thanks, Sandra. And again, I'm Harry Goodman from the Maryland Office of Oral Health. We're very honored to have been selected in this American Public Health Association webinar to discuss the impact of the Maryland Public Health Dental Hygienist Act, and we're certainly appreciative to the APHA for this grant opportunity. We hope our story demonstrates the importance of state oral health programs and its unique role in engaging stakeholders to act decisively, rise above their own agendas, and develop programs such as the Public Health Dental Hygienist Act, especially when tragedy strikes, as it did in Maryland. I'm going to provide the background and events leading to the Public Health Dental Hygienist Act, and at the end provide a brief description of the act. Next slide, please. As you can see, oral health is the foremost chronic disease in children and is far more prevalent than other more well-associated diseases and maladies of childhood. Next slide, please. To better understand oral disease, sometimes it's more effective to view it than describe it, and a picture tells a thousand stories, and many of us in public health see this on a daily basis. Next slide, please. Given the fact that oral disease can have such an impact on so many facets of a child's overall development and potential, it was still alarming about how many children we found in Maryland, one of the wealthiest states in the country, with cavities, and that a relatively small proportion of them had so few dental sealants, which are a proven oral disease prevention strategy. And as is often the case with oral health, low-income Maryland populations are disproportionately affected by this disease, with a maldistribution of dental practitioners to provide services to them. Maryland has geographic and population-based dental health profession shortage areas statewide. Next slide, please. Everything changed in Maryland with the tragic death of 12-year-old Diamante Driver in 2007 due to an untreated dental infection. Although we know of deaths of a similar nature elsewhere, this story resonated because Diamante lived in a proximal area to Washington, D.C. and our state's federal legislators. This was a tragedy in every sense of the word. Not only did Diamante, due to his low-income situation, lack access to dental treatment services, but he also lacked access to needed prevention and education services that might have helped divert his need for treatment in the first place. Next slide, please. John Comers, our Maryland Health Secretary at that time, responded almost immediately and within months convened a Dental Action Committee to develop a series of recommendations to improve oral health access in Maryland. The Dental Action Committee, or DAC, consisted of about 26 organizations representing government, professional, medical, and dental organizations, advocacy groups, insurance, and family support groups. A report was developed within 3 months, resulting in 7 main recommendations spanning many significant reforms. As you can see, all were approved, and many of them enacted within less than a year, receiving state funding through the governor's budget, and state legislative support as well was key. But what's most important here was that many of the partners who participated on the DAC had already been working together for years prior to Diamante's death on plans and activities to improve the oral health access situation in Maryland. When the DAC eventually met and deliberated, the plans flowed out and passage of all the recommendations occurred with minor opposition. Next slide, please. The following is just a list of the recommendations from the DAC and a brief summary of how these recommendations turned into real reform and action. Probably the most significant of the reforms dealt with changes in the Medicaid dental program, which previously was part of a system that contracted with multiple managed care organizations. The new dental Medicaid program, now renamed Maryland Healthy Smiles, was carved out of this system. And another very important Medicaid reform was increasing most dental procedures to a median fee charged by local dentists, as established by the American Dental Association. Other initiatives included expanding the dental public health safety net system in Maryland, piloting a dental screening program in schools that entails case management and care coordination, and developing a training program to train general dentists in clinical pediatric dentistry. Next slide, please. Other initiatives included developing a statewide oral health literacy campaign, eventually titled Healthy Teeth, Healthy Kids, which targeted low-income families of children ages 0 to 6 and pregnant women who are Medicaid eligible. Also, we instituted a statewide program, Maryland Mouths Matter, that provide Medicaid reimbursement for fluoride varnish application by medical providers during well-child services for young children, so long as they complete our training program, which provides them guidance in risk assessment, anticipatory guidance, and prevention and referral to dentists. And finally, the focal point of today's webinar, creating a new workforce category and utilizing public health dental hygienists. Next slide, please. So you can see the outcomes from these reforms. Considerably higher access for Medicaid children, greater participation by dentists in the Medicaid dental program, and a dramatic expansion of the dental safety net system. Next slide, please. And now a brief description of the Public Health Dental Hygienist Act. The legislation, which was House Bill 1280, passed in the 2008 Maryland General Assembly with a unanimous vote and was signed into law by Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley in mid-April. The law took effect in October 2008. Next slide, please. The legislation allowed for licensed dental hygienists with at least 2 years' experience and working for public health programs such as local health departments, federally qualified health centers, and other nonprofit entities to perform the full scope of dental services allowed under their scope of practice. In basically primary care settings where high-risk children and adults routinely populate to facilitate access to care for these groups. These groups would be able to benefit from the risk assessment, education, prevention services that dental hygienists are expert in providing. And working under the general supervision of a dentist at the public health program, but not having to take the dentist out of the clinical environment would expedite the provision of these services. Further, the dentist did not need to see the child first. In establishing a dental home for these populations, the hygienist then had a valid referral site for those found to be at high risk for oral diseases. After a number of years with this program in effect, with the opportunity afforded by the grant from the American Public Health Association, we thought it was a great opportunity to evaluate the impact of the act. Our state oral health program was very fortunate to receive the grant, and we hired a very capable evaluator, Deb Levy, who did a great job with the grant and who will now provide us with the results of her evaluation. Deb?
Thank you, Harry. Okay, so I'm just going to start with the purpose of the study and a little bit about the methodology and the limitations to the study. So the main purpose of the evaluation was to assess the impact of the law, but really looking at the main goals of the act, which were to increase oral health prevention and education services to low-income populations, and also to increase access to care for underserved populations in Maryland. So thinking about that goal, the Office of Oral Health, myself, and also an advisory committee that was established, set out and created 12 or identified 12 different evaluation questions. I'm just going to read off six of them, which are really the ones that that I'm going to talk about today during the presentation. The first one, to what extent, if any, has there been a change in the number of dental hygienists working in public health facilities? Looking at 1 year prior to the bill, so about 2007 until about 3 years after the bill. Also, to what extent, if any, has there been a change in the number of dentists working in public health facilities, the same time frame? How many and what proportion of children are receiving preventative services now versus before the act? Were there any factors that facilitated the implementation of the act? Also, were there any barriers blocking the implementation of the act? To what extent, if any, has there been a change in the number of patients seen by dentists in public health facilities? And also, to what extent, if any, are dental hygienists used differently now than before the legislation? And then also looking if there had been changes, how that impacted the work the dentists perform in the public health facilities. So I began the study creating a logic model and using that logic model with its outputs and outcomes to create an evaluation plan to really decide how we were going to evaluate the impact of a law. With the evaluation plan, then we identified data collection methods and also created the instruments. So the best way that I thought to gather this information was to do primarily a qualitative study, gathering information from public health hygienists, dentists, representatives from oral health organizations, from schools, from Head Starts, and then also looking quantitatively at pre-existing oral health data, WIC data, also data that the Office of Oral Health had before I came on. Okay. So the study began, the Office of Oral Health provided me with a comprehensive list of all the public health facilities in Maryland, both the local health department and the federal qualified health centers, and contacts for the public health administrators. So we started out by sending all the administrators an email, introducing the study, introducing me, and also enclosing a statement of disclosure which explained the purpose of the study, how their input would be helpful, but also explaining to them that it didn't matter if they didn't want to participate, it was okay, it wasn't going to impact any relationship they had with the Office of Oral Health. Fortunately, most administrators participated and were very responsive. From that, I then asked if they could provide contact information for their dental hygienists and dentists. And this is where the study became a little bit difficult. A lot of administrators were hesitant to provide that information. A lot of the hygienists and the dentists work hourly, and they're seeing patients the entire time they're in the clinic. And they don't want them to break necessarily to take part in an interview or respond to it outside of their work day. So I offered also to send it in survey format, which some took me up on that. Others reluctantly provided information, and from there I contacted them. So the overall response rate for the local health departments and federal qualified health centers was 85.3%, and that's the administrators. And then it was about the same broken down by each type of center. There are a few limitations in the study. Just like I had mentioned, the response rate for the dental hygienist and the dentist wasn't as high as we anticipated. We still feel like we got good information from them that's helpful. And then also just general limitations that come with interviewing and surveying is purposeful misrepresentation and social desirability. Just in interviewing people, sometimes it's possible that they provide responses that, you know, they think you want them to say. So, to limit this, when I did the interviewing, I had a good introduction that explained the importance of the information that they were providing, that all the data was going to be reported in the aggregate, and none of their, you know, individual comments were going to be attributed back to their name. Okay, so now I'm just going to go over some of the findings. So in this first chart, to assess the extent to which there had been a change in the number of dental hygienists working in public health facilities, we asked public health administrators to provide the number of dental hygienists that had worked in their clinics from 2007, if the clinics existed at that time, or to the present. If a clinic had opened after 2008, just, you know, asking for that number for as many years as they could provide. I also talked to dental hygiene school representatives and asked them to characterize any increases or changes they see in the number of students wanting to pursue careers in public health. And also dental hygienists were asked to describe how they entered the public health field, how long they had been in the dental health field, and whether or not they work elsewhere in addition to their current public health role. So as you can see in this chart, it illustrates the number of dental hygienists employed by public health dental facilities over the last 6 years. This includes full-time hygienists and full and part-time contractors. If the clinic wasn't open before 2008, we counted as zero just for that number for that year. So you can see the number of hygienists working in public health dental settings almost doubled between 2007 and 2012. This increase cannot be fully attributed to the Public Health Dental Hygiene Act, but many public health site administrators did indicate that the Act enabled them to increase the number of hygienists they employ or increase the number of hours that their hygienists were working. And three administrators that I talked to fully attributed this ability to creating the new public health dental hygiene positions in their clinics to the new law. And if that law didn't exist, they said they wouldn't have those positions. When I talked to public health school representatives, three participants indicated that they see more students in their school wanting to go into public health. However, two of those said they couldn't confirm that this was because of the Public Health Dental Hygiene Act, and that they couldn't confirm whether they pursued public health upon graduation. One did say she doubted it, mostly because of the disparity in pay between public health clinics and private clinics. Okay. So the next chart is similar, this time, though, for dentists. So as with the increase in public health dental hygienists, there was also an increase in the number of dentists. So to examine if there was any change in the number and proportion of children in Maryland receiving preventative services before and after the Act passed, I looked at Medicaid's early and periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment, EPSDT, data. The number and proportion of children receiving preventative services between 2006 and 2011 increased significantly. It's important to note that these numbers only include data from children and young adults 0 to 20 enrolled in Medicaid. And then the next slide shows the proportion. So it's not just important to see the increase, but also to look at the proportion of those individuals that are eligible and those that actually receive the treatment. And again, we see a strong increase year to year. also looked at data from the Annie Casey Foundation's Kids Count website, and they report on the percentage of children who do not receive annual dental care in Maryland. And this time we saw a steady decrease from 2006 to 2011 with an interesting sudden decrease of 7.1%. Between 2 years, but then it steadies off, and most of the changes are just about 3%. Again, we can't say that this is definitely caused by and attributed to the act, but it's very likely that its passing had an immediate impact on Maryland's underserved population access to care, which is why we see the decrease. So to understand what factors came into play during the implementation of the Public Health Dental Hygiene Act, public health site administrators, dental hygienists, and dentists were asked a series of questions. I first asked them, one, if they were aware of the act and what their understanding was to see if they were aware, if they did have a full understanding of what the act meant. If they answered yes, I then asked them to describe changes they made or had observed being made since the act's implementation. If they described changes, I asked a follow-up question about barriers and enablers in implementing these changes. If they said that no changes were made, I then asked why no changes were made. So you can see here that the administrators were the most aware of the act, followed by dental hygienists. And interestingly, the dentists were the least aware of the act, and three were not familiar at all. One thing that came up during the study that I didn't know much about before the act passed, there was a general supervision waiver that public health dental facilities could apply for, and at that point it could be rejected or it could be accepted. So it's possible that before the act passed, that public health dental hygienists could conduct all work within their scope of practice without a dentist on site. And this was brought up during the study, and it seemed that a lot of public health dental facilities didn't know the difference of that waiver versus what the act meant. And for the sites that said that they hadn't made any changes but did know of the act, when I asked about barriers, most responses that I got were that dentists didn't want to accept the new hygienist privileges. Some hygienists didn't feel comfortable working without a dentist on site. Basic budget restrictions, Head Start laws that do not allow for general supervision, generally explaining the act to the dentist and securing their buy-in was a challenge, and also finding a public health dental hygienist with the required years of experience who wanted to work in a public health setting for a smaller salary. Sorry. Okay, moving along. Aside from the interviews that I've just talked about and data on facilities in Maryland operating under general supervision, the Maryland State Board of Dental Examiners has data on the number of facilities in Maryland that are operating under general supervision for 2009 to 2012. Unfortunately, they did not collect the data before the act passed. But as you can see, from 2009 to 2011, there was a steady jump in the number of clinics operating under general supervision. In 2012, however, the number remained the same. Okay. Approximately one quarter of public health dental facilities were able to provide data on the number of patients seen in their clinics by dentists and dental hygienists. The federal qualified health centers were required to collect that information, but not all the local health departments did. So unfortunately, I couldn't look at that data that I collected on the number that they'd seen and treated. But going back to the EPSDT data, they do report on the proportion of eligible children who receive services each year from 2006 to 2011. So interestingly, in 2008, there's an interesting outlier you can see for referred for corrective treatment. The act passed in October 2008, therefore it's most likely that it did not have a large impact on that year's referrals. However, Diamante driver's death may have played some role in that. Otherwise, there was a steady increase in the percentages for all services from 2006 to 2011. I also looked at HRSA's data on FQHC specifically, and this also shows an increase in the number of Maryland residents receiving services from public health dentists and dental hygienists. As shown in the chart, more children had clinic visits with dentists and dental hygienists each year from 2006 to 2011. The number increased even more after the Public Health Dental Hygiene Act passed. Also, there was a huge jump in the number of dentist visits between 2010 and 2011. Lastly, another data source that demonstrates an increase in the number of children who are examined by a dentist each year is some data that the Office of Oral Health already had reporting on utilization rates of children on Medicaid, and this chart shows that shows this data. So after the conclusion of the study and all the data analysis, it was interesting to find out that a majority of public health dental facilities in Maryland did not change their general supervision procedures as a result of the act. Of the 35 local health departments and federal qualified health centers represented in the study, 16, or slightly less than half, now operate under that general law of supervision. But of those that do, all had significant improvements and increases in the number of children screened at schools. And this slide just shows a lot of the strong outcomes that were seen just in those sites. So at the end of my study, I provided some recommendations to the Office of Oral Health just based on the findings. The first was to increase publicity and education. Approximately 20% of the dentists and dental hygienists interviewed had never heard of the Public Health Dental Hygiene Act, and most of them were not even aware that practicing under dental supervision was even an option in Maryland. Greater awareness might lead to even more changes in public health dental facilities that, as the study show, result in greater access to care. The second is to research salary differences among public health dental hygienists and those working in private practice. Also, develop operating definitions, both of what a public health dental hygienist is and also what constitutes a public health dental facility in Maryland. And then last, to prepare a how-to guide to implementing the act. One thing that I asked when I first started the study was there any type of implementation plan, you know, how a law rolls out, like when a program started and there's an implementation plan? And there wasn't. It was just, you know, the law passed and then everyone had the right to, you know, start using a public health dental hygienist. So I thought it would be useful to prepare something for sites to have, you know, maybe referring to sites that that do take advantage of it and how they changed as a result of the act. So I'm going to pass it on now to Sue.
Thank you, Deborah.
Stop coughing.
Yes, it's springtime here in Maryland.
Yes, it is.
Thank you for your information, and I was interviewed by Deborah when they decided to do the study, and very happy that I was. I work at Chase Brexton, which is a federally qualified health center in Howard County, Maryland. I was hired in 2008, which is quite interesting because the act, of course, was passed, and I was hired to establish the school program in Howard County for the Title I schools. What we did was looked at the 12 schools that were in Howard County that were considered Title I, and Title I is a percentage of children that are qualified to have free lunch. And I was told to develop an education program, which would be appropriate for kindergarten to second grade. Those were our target grades. And I had to figure out how we were going to do this. We were to put sealants on children. We were to screen children and put fluoride varnish on children. And I also was to educate the nurses and work with the nurses. So this was a challenge that was given to me when I was first hired, and I was the first hygienist hired by Chase Brexton in 2008. So what we did is we went to the Howard County schools, and this is kind of representative of these children. We have all different kinds of teeth at Howard County schools from all over the world. It's quite an interesting – I'm going to get a map, I think, and put pins of all the children that we see from different places in the world. It's quite interesting. So what we did was we decided we would have to do mobile dental screenings and sealants. We attempted to use portable chairs. We are all females. The dentist is female, the assistant, and myself. And the chairs, if anybody's attempted to lift those, are quite heavy. So we thought, well, we tried once and it was just too much. So we decided that we would pack bags, and the bags would include what we needed for our program. We were put in on the stage. We were put in pods. We were put in small spaces like small rooms, conference rooms, and we had to figure out how to set this all up, and I'll get to that. Our first visit, everybody got the first visit, which was me, lucky them. And also I have sometimes the dental hygiene students from various schools that come with me, and we do the education. I basically do a PowerPoint presentation that's behind me so they have something to look at, but I bring my puppets and my teeth, and I also do a wonderful flossing demonstration the kids love because they get to be teeth. And everybody receives the education, whether they approve, whether their parents or guardians gave them the okay to get the fluoride varnish and screening. We felt it important that everybody get the education. We also give toothbrushes to all of the children in grades K through the second grade, so they all get toothbrushes so they'll remember us as well. So when we go to our second visit, this is Tanika, our new dental assistant, and also a front desk person. She kind of doubles for us sometimes. And you can see we're in a conference room there, if you look at that picture. And we have our toothbrushes if we have to clean their teeth, because sometimes even early morning, of course, they don't have their teeth brushed. And we have our fluoride varnish, and we have sealants. And what we do is we do the screenings for kindergarten, stopped actually because of funding changes. So we actually go now from pre-K was in the beginning. Now we do kindergarten to second. So the kindergartners would be our last because our most labor intense would be the second graders. So we start with our second graders to determine if they need sealants. We used to put sealants in all teeth. We used to do three visits. We're only doing two, again, funding cuts. So with that, we will take the second graders first, and we'll look to see if they need sealants. Some of them may have sealants, but if they don't have sealants, we'll use our MASH unit, I say. And I do MASH because it's not the Mobile Army Surgical Hospital, but Mobile Access School Health, because, again, we can't take chairs and all of that to the schools. We're seeing, like today we saw 89 children, so it's quite a few children. And what we do is we dry the teeth. We use an LPOP, and some of you are familiar with that, and we have gotten some good results. We are checking that this year. So we use the LPOP, and we use sealants, and we use the light, the typical light, and it's a unit dose sealant, and those sometimes are challenging to find, so we're using HelioSeal now. And in our bag, we carry all of this in all of our supplies so that we can set it out in these small spaces. So the children in second grade get our sealants, and then they also get fluoride varnish. And if they have any concerns, they get usually a pink piece of paper. Some schools have different colors to alert the parents that we saw something suspicious. Again, we're only using a mouth mirror. We're only doing screenings. I, along with the dentist, do this, but I have done it without the dentist present because if she's sick or unable to be there, it would be myself and the dental assistant. Okay. So last year in Howard County, we saw almost 3,000 children for the education visit. Dental screenings and fluoride varnish, we saw 1,260, about 43% of the children were seen. And we placed 398 sealants on 159 children. So that's quite a few of children who probably would not have been seen had they not been able to come to our visit, because a lot of children that we have in Howard County in certain areas are new to our area and may not have access to Medicaid, so quite a few of our children do not have insurance either. So this year we're actually going to be checking the dental sealant retention, and as I said, we are using a MASH unit, so we are not air drying and doing all the things that you normally do in a dental office because we don't have the equipment available. What I found is that the retention rate seems to be about 60% so far of the children that we've been able to check. The challenge is that the children have either left the school that they were in last year, these would be the third graders, or they have moved out of the area. So we have to go in that first visit. I will ask for the third graders who we sealed at second grade, and I'll check for sealant retention. And if the sealants have been lost, then we will have them come back at the second visit to place the sealants on those teeth that where they lost the sealants. So I was hired in the beginning to do the school-based program. We then had a two new outreach programs that Dr. Woodward, my director, thought was wonderful, and I agree. One was the WIC, which is in Howard County as well, and the other was the Head Start. And the Head Start, we actually do the screenings in Baltimore County, not in Howard County, and I'll explain that. So at the WIC screenings, I see children age 1 or first tooth, because as you know, some children get first teeth early, and I don't necessarily say no, because that's an important time when mommies are there or daddies or grandmas, and it's very important to actually educate them not just about oral health but about nutrition. It's a very, very important aspect of WIC as well. I had to develop education for the WIC staff so that they know what I'm doing, why I'm doing it, who I am, what oral health is, why it's important to brush teeth, even though at WIC they do talk about it. A lot of them really don't have any education about it, so the staff was very important to get on board to help me market what we were doing. And then I had to also design something, okay, so what are we going to do here, again, in a small space, in an area of a room to be able to look at the child's teeth and also make sure that there's no problems with the child's teeth. I also needed to have educational information, not just me talking to the parents, but also educational information to give them to take home. We have a large population of Spanish speakers here, so that was important, and, of course, the English material as well. And all my material I'm very fortunate to get from the Department of Oral Health or from NIH, which has free materials that can be distributed at no cost to us, but it really, I think, helps the people that are able to get it. And so what I do at WIC is the oral health education, of course. Also included in that is the nutritional education, because a lot of parents aren't aware of the sugar content. Of those of you that are in oral health, you understand that. And then screen for anything abnormal to let the parents know, and then apply fluoride varnish and give referrals as needed. So I do a lap exam for those who are little, because the age group is, of course, from first tooth to age 5 years old. That would be WIC. And the mommy can see, and we have daddies too and grandmas, so the child can see the caregiver and is less likely to cry, even though sometimes they do, but it's quite all right. We do a toothbrush prophy, not to scare the child, and then apply fluoride varnish and give a referral to any of the children who may need that. I do see children, as you saw in the earlier slides from Dr. Goodman, who may have teeth that look like that, unfortunately. But a lot of them we see very early, and everything looks wonderful. And then I give them a referral to us if it's everything looks okay to come see me at Chase Brexton in 6 months, where we'll do a more thorough exam with a light and an explorer. If there's a problem, I have several pediatric dentists, thanks to our DAC committee that started getting more pediatric dentists involved in Medicaid. So I have several referrals that I can give them if they need to see a pediatric dentist, which is very wonderful. So with the Head Start, Dr. Woodward talked with one of the Head Start people in Baltimore, and they had problems with not having the children not having anybody to go to for an evaluation for their Head Start program. So Dr. Woodward worked with the person at Head Start in Baltimore County and volunteered me. Sue can do this. I'm sure she can. And I did. It was wonderful. I would go to the various Head Start programs in Baltimore County with my GPS, because I had no clue where I was going, being from Howard County. And, again, I would bring my bag, my rolly bag. So I have 3 bags, one for Head Start, one for oral health education, and one for sealants and screenings at the schools. And with that, I would do a toothbrush prophy, exam with a mirror, apply fluoride varnish, and refer as needed. The Department of Oral Health produces each year a booklet of all of the people who, all the dental providers that accept Medicaid. So if I'm in an area that I'm not familiar with, I can refer them to that booklet, or I can bring referrals for those who I know will accept Medicaid if the children have Medicaid. This particular part of my job has been taken over from our new public health dental hygienist, Karen Carr Porter, who's now in the Baltimore office. I'm at the Howard County office, and she too finds this very interesting and fun to see all the children. So now what do I really do when I'm not doing outreach at the schools, WIC, and at when I was at the Head Start? I do see patients at the dental clinic. I am a traditional hygienist in the sense that I can see new patients, children, adults, special needs patients. We take, the good news about us is we have a fee scale, sliding fee scale based on income. So if we have patients, and we have several patients that I may refer from WIC, the mommies that may not have insurance or the daddies, and we can do a sliding fee scale so that they will have access to dental care. If they are Medicaid eligible, we have at Chase Brexton folks that can work with them, our case managers, to see if maybe they do, they may be eligible for Medicaid. And then, of course, we accept most insurances. I can see all patients all times without the doctor present. If I see a need, if a new patient comes in, and I see a need that the patient has a lot of dental treatment that's needed, we would then have the dentist do the examination after I see the patient and refer, and she then would do a treatment plan. The only caveat with treating adult patients is that if I need to give local anesthesia, which I am licensed to do in the state of Maryland, I am not able to do that if the dentist is not present. So that's the caveat of treatment for adults who may need scaling and root planing with anesthesia. I would have to have the dentist present. But by and large, because I'm able to see patients, if the dentist is not there, if the dentist has an emergency or has taken time off, I'm able to see those patients and perform the traditional dental hygiene scope of practice. Let me see what else we have left here. So the benefits of a public health hygienist in the state of Maryland and benefits of the Dental Hygiene Act, it's access to care for more people of all ages. It's access to a dental home. We're able to give them a dental home now. If we can say to Chase Brexton, we have pediatric dentists that will be able to see the young children. If we have special needs patients that we can't handle, we have University of Maryland, and we're very fortunate to have that. We have access for education and for treatment for all, which we didn't have. And, of course, in the school, they're getting education in the Title I schools. Today, the nurse that I was working with at one of the schools said, you know, we really would like to have this for all schools, not just Title I, because all our children need it. And I'm hoping this will be something in the future that all our children are able to access education and screenings at all schools. So the good news is the dentist and the hygienist, we all collaborate for access to all. So that is what I do as a public health hygienist and Chase Brexton, in collaboration with Chase Brexton, and thank you. I will turn it over now to Sandra.
Thank you. Thank you to all of our presenters. This is a great presentation. Unfortunately, we have about 15 minutes for questions, and we've been getting a pretty steady flow. Just a reminder, if you do have a question, please submit it using the chat function on the lower left-hand corner of your screen. And I'm going to direct our first question. I think this is probably best answered by Harry or Sue. And the question is, what are the specific duties of public health hygienists as opposed to one in private practice? And also, what additional training is needed for hygienists to become public health dental hygienists?
This is Harry. I guess I'll field that one. First of all, in terms of the training, it's basically the same experience as any other private practice dental hygienist, that it has to be a minimum of 2 years. There's also criteria for how many hours of clinical experience that the Maryland State Board of Dental Examiners sets. Other than that, there is no additional training. These are hygienists that are then employed by the public health sector, whether it be a local health department, a federally qualified health center, or other nonprofit sector. And of course, abide by, you know, are hired and recruited by whatever standards that those public health programs provide. The difference is number one, that only public health hygienists can go to the so-called primary care settings, such as schools, WIC, Head Start, such as has been described previously. But they can work under the general supervision of a dentist, and the dentist does not need to be on site to see the patient first. This provides a more cost-effective model. This expedites matters. It allows us to get to these venues where these low-income populations are to better reach them. And this is, we're really following evidence-based guidelines, that have been set by national organizations. Hygienists, the public health hygienists, essentially do everything that a private sector hygienist can do, but only out in the field. They don't do anything additional, but everything that's allowed within their scope of practice, which, of course, is the bulk of various preventive services ranging from sealants, fluoride varnish, and, of course, they provide education and whatever training, and then become the link from that site, that primary care site, to the local health department where the dentist would be. And so for any kids that are found when they do assessment that are at high risk for oral disease, they're then able to be referred back to the clinic. They don't provide exams. They provide screenings such as any other hygienist. So it's a non-billable procedure. But anything else is again, something that they're able to do and then refer back to the public health site. And provides it facilitates a dental home for these kids. And what is good is that these hygienists are able to come back time and time again to the same sites within their jurisdiction to continue to provide these needed services.
Great, thank you. I'm going to direct this question to Deb. Is there any way to isolate the effects of the Public Health Hygiene Act from the other reforms in the Act, or effects of the Public Health Hygienist, from the other reforms in the Public Health Hygiene Act?
I'm not sure exactly what you mean by the other reforms specifically. For this study, just what funding allowed and time allowed, we really only could look at the increases in access to care for children and adults in Maryland, based on interviews with the dental hygienists and the public health administrators and then already existing oral health data. So we can't draw a direct conclusion that the Public Health Dental Hygiene Act is what caused all these increases, although I think that, based on what we found, we can take a piece of it that had something to do with it, and it definitely, the data goes in the right direction. And also the feedback, qualitatively, the data from the public health administrators, the dental hygienists, and the dentists that do participate in the act and implement it within their clinics, they do attribute to the greater numbers of people that they see to the act.
Sandra, can I just add to that, that this is, this is sort of a great example of private-public partnerships, and we had a private sector model in terms of Medicaid and then the public health sector. And in terms of our expansion of the safety net system that then allowed more public health hygienists to work in more public health venues. So when the Dental Action Committee put together these recommendations, every one of them sort of worked in tandem. They really worked as a collective, and we always would say that if one failed, it might pull down the other ones, and fortunately they didn't. So it's very hard to isolate one particular reform as improving the situation in Maryland, but I think they all work as a tandem together.
Great, thank you. Another question was, and I think pretty much anyone could answer this, given the positive experience of this law, do you envision further additions to the workforce, such as dental therapists?
Right now, the directive for us to go down this road with public health dental hygienists was the recommendation that came out of the Dental Action Committee, and then this particular workforce model was then passed through legislation. So this is the one that we've been working. We really feel that this particular model is the ultimate in a preventive workforce model. And we found that when, at the time of Diamante Driver's tragic passing, that Not only were we wanting in terms of access to care, but we really were wanting in terms of our prevention and public health activities that would, you know, that would maybe prevent a problem in the long run. So our thought was to really front load dental hygienists in terms of providing services and activities as early as possible, as young to kids as possible in these particular venues. And that's the model we basically have chosen. And I think the results, you know, again, as I said, collectively speak for themselves. I think that we'd always be cognizant of these other models and have to evaluate each and every one of them as they would relate to Maryland. But right now, this is the model that we have gone down the road in terms of the recommendations, and I think it's been a really good one.
Okay, another question. How did local dental practices respond to the act, and how do you interact with local practices? And I'm guessing that would be for Sue.
How did they respond? They're very happy that we're actually out there doing some of the services that these children can't access. You have to remember in most of, you saw Deb's information regarding the kids that don't have or haven't accessed Medicaid. We have a large population, at least in Howard County. Our children don't have any insurance. So if we have children without insurance, they can at least access care through us, and we can do a sliding fee scale. For those who have Medicaid, the dentists are really happy that we're out there as seeing these children and then referring as needed to the dentist that would be able to perform any advanced services they may need as far as restoration or hospital OR. Some of them are so advanced. So it's a very good collaboration.
Thank you. Someone asked a clarifying question. Must all public health dental hygienists receive their general supervision from a federally qualified health center? If not, why were these the only sites included in the evaluation?
Do you want to take it, Harry?
Okay, you can take it.
Oh, at least from the hygienist that I spoke with most, their direct supervision was with a dentist on site in their local health department or federal qualified health center. However, there was one person who used to work in private practice, and her dentist that she worked with, who still was in private practice, was the person on paper that she reported to. But it really was mostly just, you know, on paper or in an emergency situation. But we actually didn't even talk about including them in the study. I think it's very rare that someone in private practice is supervising a public health dental hygienist. What do you think about that, Sue?
As far as the hygienists that are going to be working in a public health setting?
Yeah, I think most of the dentists in that site, at that site, were the ones supervising them.
Yes, well, we have, yes. So, for instance, me, I have, there are three dentists at Chase Brexton. I'm under the direct supervision, supervision of Dr. Woodward, who's the director of us. And he's the one that has the approval from the state board to be have a public health hygienist. So it would be the director of whatever program is involved with this. And, of course, we have the public health hygienist in the health departments as well. So it's not just the federally qualified health centers.
We've gotten a few questions about reimbursement. One person asked just generally how services are reimbursed, and then we had two questions about whether or not Medicaid reimburses the public health dental hygienist directly or only through the employer/supervising dentist.
Medicaid, it's the latter. Medicaid reimburses the site, which is the billing center for these services. The hygienist is essentially as if the dentist went out to the school, it would be the same situation. They would go out and provide services, and then it would be billed by the public health site. Now some of our public health programs also just do provide these services at no cost either. So it just depends on the particular model, but they're free to bill Medicaid, but it's the site that does the particular billing. It's not, there is no direct reimbursement to dental hygienists in Maryland.
Another question was whether or not there are other school-based oral health programs in Maryland besides just the one in Howard County.
Oh, absolutely. We really have, and this has been an area that we've really greatly improved over the last few years in providing these programs, and our saturation into Title I schools, Head Start programs, and WIC programs has just been amazing over these past few years. As I said earlier, it was an area that we really were kind of weak, and we're still not there by any stretch, but we've done really, really well. But we have programs statewide. Some programs have been in existence for well over 20, 25 years. One of our county programs won a national award back in the 1990s for its school-based sealant program. And we actually had some pretty good best practices to actually look at when we began to really, truly institute a true statewide model. And that's really what we've done. I mean, this is the first time this office has really instituted a more of a statewide approach and working in providing separate grant dollars to many different programs providing these services. But it's all over the state.
Sue, I have two questions for you. The first is whether or not the exams you do as a dental hygienist count towards the federal requirement that Head Start has to get kids exams within 90 days?
Yes. That's why we go in there, because they have not gotten the exams.
Okay.
We're helping them out by going in there to do the examinations for the parents who aren't able to access care.
Sue, but I got to correct you there that it's great that the hygienists are going in and doing risk assessment and everything, but the screening does not count towards the PIR, the performance,
right.
The program information report. That is separate. That has to be.
That's the part Harry knows. I just know that we go in there because they need to have it, and then they have to go be assessed. Correct.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Harry.
No, that's okay. But it doesn't weaken the argument that we need hygienists to go into Head Start programs and provide the initial risk assessment and screening, and then all the other services that you're able to provide, and actually, you know, do an early identification of kids who might need care. But the actual counting towards the federal performance standards has to be done by a dentist and an exam.
And another one for Sue. What is the encounter rate per child for the toothbrush prophy exam with mirror and fluoride varnish?
It depends upon the child. It's not very long. Depending, it could be minutes, like 2 minutes brushing, but it may be seconds. If the child, we had a child today that wouldn't even let us look. He was a first grader. He probably had some sort of a concern, ADHD or a syndrome, and he would not even let us look but for a second. So it depends on the child, but not very long, at least 2 minutes if we're doing a brushing. And that would be a toothbrush prophy, and then adding the fluoride varnish.
Okay. In the interest of time, I'm only going to field one more question, but what we do like to do is we'll collate all of the questions and have the speakers answer them in writing, and we'll post them on our website with the recording and slides. So last question is for Deb. Someone was asking about whether or not they can access the guide to implement the law that you mentioned.
The guide was just a recommendation to the Office of Oral Health based on the findings of the study. So there actually isn't a how-to guide. It was only a suggestion.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Well, thank you to everyone for being on the webinar with us today, especially our speakers. And just a reminder, the recording and slides will be available, and we'll also try and post the answers to the questions that we were unable to answer, and you will get an email when everything is up on the web. Once the webinar is closed out, an evaluation survey will pop up, and we would greatly appreciate it if you could take the time to complete that. And I just wanted to let you know that APHA will also be having another webinar on May 9th, and that will be about built environment policy strategies. Thank you again, everyone, and I hope you have a great day.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude the webinar for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines.